Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Sorry about that. Sometimes you gotta hire better help. Okay, starting again from the top, this is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland. I'm the editor of Atomic Insights and the host of The Atomic Show.
This is John Wheeler coming from Highland, New York, and I'm the producer of This Week in Nuclear podcast.
My name is Kelly Taylor. I'm a work-at-home mom and occasional blogger on NEI Nuclear Notes. I have 21 years experience in nuclear power, both in operations and engineering.
This is Robert Margolis calling from Palm Beach, Florida. I am a reactor engineer, and in the past I've also been a startup engineer and safety analyst.
And this is Michael Stewart from the thriving metropolis of Beaver Dam, Virginia. I'm a senior nuclear instructor for Dominion Resources, and I was the former public information officer for North American Young Generation in Nuclear.
And it's great to have you all here. And this is an attempt to make John and maybe my life a little easier, because John was struggling with getting his preps done for This Week in Nuclear. So he said, you know, if I get a bunch of friends together and we just talk, maybe I won't have to do so much work.
A little self-serving, but I really do think that it would be a much more engaging podcast for the listeners as well. I really like some of the shows that you did earlier with Shane, Rod, and I think that's one of the things that made those very interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, I wish I could get him back, but he's unfortunately working for people that think that the second law of thermodynamics is classified. So,
well, I got my start in the same place he's working now, so I understand where he's coming from.
That's all right. So did I. I just ignore the rules. No, I don't. I haven't talked to those people about that particular topic for a long time, so I feel like, you know, the decay, my half-life is to the point where it's now my own knowledge and not theirs. And if those of you who don't understand the illusions, tough. All right. So, Robert, you just finished an interesting evolution down there in Florida. What did you guys just finish doing?
Well, at the St. Lucie plant, we've just finished an outage where we put in new steam generators, new reactor head, and containment sump modifications, which a lot of the plants right now are going through the putting in new modifications for containment sump in response to NRC the NRC generic letters.
You did that all at once?
We're not as good, though, as Fort Calhoun. Fort Calhoun did reactor vessel head, pressurizer, and steam generators and main transformer in 60 days.
Ew.
How long did it take y'all then, Robert?
Our outage was over 90 days.
But under 100.
Under 100. Well,
under 100 is pretty impressive.
I think with Fort Calhoun, they had the advantage of if they didn't get it done in time, they'd all freeze or something. So they.
You don't have that issue down in Florida, I guess.
So far, we haven't.
Well, that's good. When we first started doing steam generator replacement, that would take 100 days.
Well, Robert, I was a senior reactor operator at Turkey Point for a few years in the late 80s and early 90s, and one of the coldest Christmases I have ever spent was in Miami. And that was the year that ice formed in some of the plant equipment and caused both units at Turkey Point to trip offline.
I've heard stories from the old-timers about that. Moderately, yes.
I was a very young senior reactor operator.
Well, that's okay. I can boast of being a reactor engineer at Fort St. Vrain, which puts me about 20 years back, at least. So. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons I like you, Robert. You're one of the few guys I know who's actually operated a gas-cooled reactor.
Well, Melinden Blue claims all I did was shut down his gas-cooled reactor, but we tried our best.
Really? Because it didn't operate all that long, or...?
Oh, I was there in its last year of operation, and I was on shift when we had a rod stuck. We were doing our rod drop surveillance, and one of the rods got stuck, and that happened to be when they had to shut down for that. That was it. And when I was introduced to Linden Blue, someone happened to mention he was the reactor engineer on shift, and the first thing Linden Blue said, "So you're the guy that shut down my plant."
Well, somebody had to do it.
Well, I offered to start up whatever his next one is, and so far haven't. I guess so far GA hasn't had the opportunity to make good.
Sometimes one might think that they haven't provided themselves the opportunity, but that's just my own feeling. The Fort St. Vrain reactor, when was that, Robert, that it actually shut down?
That shut down in 89, and it started, I think it was 75, 76. It might have been a little later than that, but it was in the mid to late 70s it started up, and it had a cumulative lifetime capacity factor of 14%.
Yeah, it was a first-of-a-kind unit, and there was very little industrial infrastructure to fix the things that went wrong.
It also had some workforce issues as well. Right. They had a lot of folks from coal plants who had never seen a reactor, so they had some other issues.
Yeah, but
both
Robert,
design and
wouldn't that have been true of most of the reactors of that vintage? Wouldn't most
well,
of the
small
people operating the reactors of that vintage have come over from the coal side?
Well, in the 1970s, there were enough folks around in nuclear. They had a few Navy nukes. They had a few folks from other nuclear stations. But I literally can say I was one of three persons with a nuclear degree on site at that time.
Because of the demographics of where the reactor was located?
I think it was also just that the utility, it was their one reactor. This was, of course, long before nuclear fleets, when the local utility, somebody got the idea to build a reactor, and then they had it, and okay, now what do we do with it? Like a SMUD or something like that, where they build it, and then another generation of folks comes along and says, how do we run this thing? Especially in the case of the Fort St. Vrain, on paper, it looked like just a fancy version of a coal plant. It had superheated steam. They thought, oh, we'll get all this helium from the natural gas wells in Colorado. This thing's going to be wonderful. And Peach Bottom 1, which was the first gas-cooled reactor GA built, it ran pretty well. It had a few issues with its with the oil-lubricated circulators, which are the same thing as the reactor coolant pumps in a water reactor. But it didn't have too many issues, and they were basically trying to scale it up, and they ran into some design issues with the circulators, and also they had some issues with the liner coolant, but the core ran was very interesting. The core, they had done many tests where they'd shut off all cooling and nothing really would go on with it. So it was a very impressive, from a nuclear design standpoint, it was very impressive. It was just that it came along also too late. Once all the other orders stopped, GA lost their other orders so they could go and perfect the design.
So they didn't have a self-sustaining market.
That's true. It was in a sense bad timing.
Well, there's an interesting history behind that loss of orders that I have a little bit of a skeptical or cynic's view of it. I don't like the passive voice. I think that GA's new investor went out and killed the orders rather than GA losing the orders.
Well, also, it did not help to have such a low capacity factor and always be hearing about problems versus the water-cooled reactors, which did have a big jump from the Navy plants and also those that had been built in the 60s. So,
sure.
So there was a utilities, I've found are, they generally want something off the shelf.
Yes, that's very true. But I'll, for those of you who don't understand my allusions, I'll elaborate just a little bit. General Atomics, when they had the gas-cooled reactor built, there was a lot of excitement because it did have a much higher efficiency. It had an interesting core design that looked like it was going to be very safe and easier to operate. The helium coolant was providing very good after-shutdown radiation levels. So there were about 10 orders placed for an upgraded version of the first gas-cooled reactor. General Atomics is a small company and didn't have the capital necessary to go build 10 reactors, so they had to go find capital. And what they found was a big investor to come and buy the company. The investor happened to be the Gulf Oil Company. So General Atomics became Gulf General Atomics.
Ouch.
And within about, less than 2 years after that transaction took place, General Atomics, which went into the company, went into the partnership with 10 orders, had no orders left. So I don't know if that's the due diligence of the company after they purchased General Atomics, said, hey, there's issues with this design, we really can't go sell it. Or my cynical side says, well, geez, if these guys really make do with nuclear power, what's that going to do to our other market?
Yeah, it wasn't part of their business model.
Well, it was obviously part a large enough part of their business model to go buy the company.
Right.
Well, I think they probably were just looking at the time they bought it in the mid, I think it was like probably pre-1978 when everything was being built, coal, oil, gas. Well, I shouldn't say oil and gas because the Fuel Use Act was in effect at that time, but anything that wasn't oil and gas was considered a gold mine, and then all of the orders were canceled, not just nuclear. If you look, if I remember the numbers right, it was 110 nuclear plants were canceled and 56 coal plants, and it was the equivalent ratio of orders.
Right. Well, more of the new plants that were under construction at that time, back in the 70s, late 70s, when the utility rate of growth started slowing down, the rate of consumption of electricity, the only new plants to be canceled were nuclear and coal. Because, as you said, there were no gas plants being constructed because there was a law against it. The Fuel Use Act said you can't build gas plants in the U.S.
One of the myths that I'm constantly trying to eliminate from the anti-nuclear vernacular is this myth that the accident at Three Mile Island is what caused utilities to cancel nuclear plant orders. It certainly played a role in the subsequent years in terms of the financial environment for constructing nuclear plants, and the regulatory framework certainly caused prices to go up. But the canceling of nuclear and coal plants was already well underway when the Three Mile Island accident occurred.
Yes, so an accident that occurs after the cancellations began can't be the cause of the cancellations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about gas-cooled reactors, and there's the United Kingdom has a long history of running gas-cooled reactors, and in the last week or so, they have announced that they're going to begin building new nuclear plants. So I'm just wondering, from the perspective of those of you who are more in tune to gas-cooled reactor technology, is there any chance that any of the new reactors will be gas-cooled?
Right now, it looks to me like that's a no, because as I think it was Robert that just said, utilities like to buy the known. And what's known right now and what's being offered is pressurized water or boiling water reactors.
And also, of course, we're seeing what's going on in South Africa and China. I think folks are going to wait to see if the South Africans and the Chinese go ahead with their gas-cooled designs and how they work, just as folks in the U.S. are looking at the reactors being built in China.
Yep. Yeah, I think right now the only gas-cooled reactor that's operating outside of the AGRs in the U.K. Is the Chinese high-temperature reactor.
And the HTTR in Japan.
Yes, I forget that one. That's how big is that one?
30 megawatts thermal, and the Chinese one is 10 megawatts thermal. And the just really quick, the Chinese one is the pebble bed design, like the one in Germany that uses kind of the billiard balls. Kelly's heard me call it nuclear pachinko sometimes, but it is a good design. And the Japanese model is very similar to the General Atomics, which uses small rodlets in a graphite block.
What was the power level on Fort St. Vrain?
Fort St. Vrain was 330 megawatts. It's interesting with the helium cool. Just another quick thing, the British reactors are CO2 are cooled with carbon dioxide. The high temperature reactors use helium, and the other reactor that was in Germany, the THTR, that was also around 330, might have been 350 megawatts.
Electric. Yeah. It was, 300 megawatts electric is what I remember, because I think it was called the THTR 300, but I could be wrong.
Sort of like how the AP1000 is 1200 megawatts.
Well,
or 1150.
As you know, the economy of scale always causes one to force that power level up. That's when you do the economic calculations, it always looks easy to just pump it up a little bit.
Plug in the modern capacity factor, and it probably evens out to be 1,000.
Yeah. Well, as you guys have all experienced, many of the plants operating in the U.S. today have been upgraded from their original design limit because of adding better steam generators or a few other tweaks that have been done in the design.
There's some other drivers that make that possible and reasonable and feasible, too. When in the 70s, when they were building nuke stations, what they were building was things that they knew, proven technologies and stuff, but they weren't things that they had a long runtime on. And once you experience what it's capable of, when you're not sure, when you're an engineer and you're not sure and you're designing, you build a lot of margin in to cover the things that you can't predict to happen. When you get hundreds of years cumulatively of runtime on these reactors, there's a lot less that you are not sure about. You've seen how they respond under different transient conditions and stuff like that. So you can take that extra margin that was put in there for unknowns. There's fewer unknowns, and you can use that margin to make power with.
Yeah. And it's
and that plays into the decision-making of the utility executives as well, because as the capacity factors go up and the reliability goes up, the risk associated with selecting a design that's more proven goes down from a financial standpoint. And utilities in the United States and probably around the world have historically been relatively conservative, regulated entities. And even though a lot of utilities have entered the deregulated marketplace, many of the decision-making executives and senior leaders grew up in an environment that was very adverse to risk. And so when they get into selecting reactor designs, they're going to choose the thing that they perceive as having the less risk.
That's true. That's one of the reasons why my company has been looking at designs that are not focused on utility-sized plants, because the customers that we're looking at tend to have a little bit higher acceptance of doing things that haven't been tried and true yet. They still don't like to take risks. People are still pretty conservative, and I'm a pretty conservative guy myself, but sometimes you have to do things differently to make big improvements.
Well, I noticed in the Union of Concerned Scientists released their new report that was titled Nuclear Power in a Warming World. And they made a statement in their report that I thought was interesting. They made a statement that the safest of the proposed new designs is the EPR reactor that Areva is building and promoting in the United States.
Favorite?
That was UCS's favorite.
Okay.
And I thought that was interesting because that's the largest of all the current plants that's that are being marketed, and it's also the most complex.
It's also the one that has the least amount of passive safety features, I thought.
That's right. It is. So I just thought it was very unusual. You know, the EPR is a neat design, and it's, you know, certainly has a lot to offer, but it's not really a revolutionary design as much as it is an evolution of the current existing plants.
Well, I've read interviews with Dave Lockbaum, and he often will say things about his mistrust of advanced features or advanced designs. He often says about getting out the bugs from the current generation. I once said to someone, that sounds like we have to wait until the DC-3 has no mistakes before we can move on to these funky jet things. Or,
so, yeah.
Or, you know, that we have to figure out how to make vacuum tubes last long enough before we try any of this digital technology in our computers. So I think there's it might even be a little bit of conservatism, or I shouldn't say conservatism, conservative thinking in that regard.
Well, I think it's being generous to call that conservative thinking, because I really believe that it's a very risky thinking to believe that you have to have nuclear be perfect before it can be acceptable, particularly when we live in a country where there's 470 coal-fired power plants. And I just read a long article in the Washington Post this weekend about some of the conditions in Virginia mines. People working 12-hour days, you know, spending that whole day in a mine shaft that's only 40 inches tall, and believe it or not, the people are racked with pain as they get older in life, and some of them are turning to drugs to make it so they can actually work for a living. Pretty horrific stuff.
And also, if you actually look in the report, the things they say about gas-cooled reactors are just plain wrong. They give a very low temperature for fast graphite oxidation. I think it was something like 500 degrees centigrede, where even the Fort St. Vrain graphites could go well above 1,800 degrees. So technical errors in that report.
Right. Of course, it's also very difficult to oxidize graphite if there's no oxygen in the system to begin with.
That's right. You know, as Kelly mentioned too, you know, the EPR reactor does not really rely on natural forces of nature for its plant safety systems. And, you know, the AP1000 and the ESBWR both make much more use of safety systems that don't rely on electricity, for example, to be running in order to function.
Yeah, they have much bigger storage tanks and gravity-fed systems and that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
I heard that comment made, but I can't take credit for it because I'm not familiar with the EPR design.
Okay.
The EPR is very, I want to say it follows what I recall from my work in Europe. Having several trains at once, having one train always in maintenance to minimize your refueling outages, and also, of course, they have the dual wall containment, but again, they don't have the passive features. And
that,
of course,
dual wall containment one of the things that made the UCS happy?
That was one of the things that made the UCS happy. The UCS. Their reasoning is, well, no one's built a passive cooled reactor with water, so therefore we don't know what it will do. And of course, by that same token, a lot of other technological developments probably wouldn't have happened if people had that same mindset.
Right. You can't build it until you've built it.
That's
exactly.
Correct.
Well, and how much proof does it take to know that water flows downhill,
or
from high
rises.
Pressure, or high pressure sends fluid to low pressure, you know. So there are certain principles and laws of physics that are going to work regardless of whether it's an old design or a new design.
Well,
yeah, they seem pretty conservative assumptions that you assume gravity will continue to work.
But you know, the UCS has been really pushing the double walled containment, and so that may be something that they are in favor of, and see that as an opportunity to promote that idea. Of course, it adds a tremendous amount of expense for not a lot of gain when it comes to actual safety for the public.
Yep. Well, it's just amazing to me, having walked through the containment vessels of a number of different plants and seeing the videos of them being constructed, and then having been nearby the Pentagon when a plane ran into it. I just think that a plane hitting a containment is going to go splat like a bug, because, you know, the aircraft are not...
You might be amazed to learn, Calvin, that makes it remarkably difficult to hear the phone.
I couldn't hear you, Kelly. What'd you say?
That was a bye-bye.
I was speaking offline.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Kelly
is
a mom.
To, anyway.
Yeah, she...
I couldn't hear her over the piano. I was thinking that was something I could cure.
And of course, I know that one of the anti-claims, they will often use the speed of the planes hitting the Twin Towers versus the speed of the planes hitting the Pentagon, and saying, oh, well, if you hit a reactor at 600 miles an hour, and I kept thinking if they can recruit the Blue Angels to fly these planes for them, that would be amazing, but I just don't see them being able to fly that low, a regular type person flying a plane that low that fast.
Right. I seem to recall having seen a video of an A-4 intruder being flown into a simulated containment wall, and there would be nothing left of the plane at all, with just minimal scarring on the concrete surface of the containment wall. So it seems to me that a fully loaded and mostly hollow large jet would be more of the same.
Yeah, fully loaded, mostly hollow, very thin-skinned for weight reasons.
Jet. Tin can.
Yeah.
Moving very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Since we're all talking about airplanes and crashing, I'm going to have to sign off because I have to go catch an airplane.
Hey, John.
I'm so glad we were able to remind you.
John, just make sure that the pilot doesn't decide to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Take care.
I'm sure. It'll be a very boring and monotonous flight, God willing.
Yes.
It was nice talking to all of you today, and I'll be interested in listening to the show so I can hear what happened.
Okay. Take care and fly safe.
All right. You guys have a good afternoon.
Safe travel.
Okay. Now that John's gone, we can talk about it behind his back.
All right.
No.
I don't know him too well. You're going to have to fill me in on all the details.
You don't know. Do you listen to a show? That's how you get to know somebody. You go online and you listen to This Week in Nuclear. John does a great job with pulling together news from around the world. And speaking of news from around the world, we kind of touched on it briefly, but I'm really excited about the effort that the UK went through to gather responses from their public and then make a decision that they really can't even come close to meeting their emissions targets without building a new generation of nuclear plants. And one thing that is interesting, though, is that they have stated that they're not going to provide any subsidies for the industry, yet there's all kinds of interest from utilities throughout Europe, from the suppliers, Westinghouse, Areva, General Electric, Hitachi, Mitsubishi. They're all piling into the country.
EDF and E.ON have both expressed interest. EDF has said they have plans to build 4 nuclear reactors already. I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
In England.
Yeah. And again, this is in a country that has said repeatedly, we're not going to offer subsidies. All we're going to do is establish a predictable, steady path of regulations that allows people, if they meet the criteria, to build plants. And I'm an investor in British Energy, and I've been very pleased at the pop that it's received over the last few days.
And it's also interesting that this is happening under a Labour government.
Yeah.
Which is typically you don't think of them as as promoting or at least allowing nuclear.
Well, I think a lot of things have changed in the UK with regard to labor and its relationship with nuclear. And one of the things that's changed is, although the UK still has some coal left and still uses coal for a fair amount of its power production, I think that right now 40% of the coal being burned in the UK is imported. So the strength of the labor unions and the amount of jobs left in the coal mines has been dramatically reduced. And it was, quite frankly, the coal unions which had a big problem with nuclear power in the early days, or that was part of the opposition.
And where is their supply of coal coming from?
South Africa, I think, is the biggest supplier. And they may be getting some from Australia as well. But I was in Europe this summer, and a lot of the, even though Europe is planning to build a number of new coal plants, much of that coal is imported coal coming from South Africa or Australia, which is a long darn way to ship coal. It literally is. Coal's coming to Newcastle these days. It's an old line, you know, coal's to Newcastle. It used to be where Great Britain's wealth was established based on some of its coal underneath the Wales countryside.
Yes, it is ironic because England was one of the first countries where people started burning coal.
Yep. And it was part of I mean, one of the more interesting pieces of history is that England thought they were going to run out of coal until some guy developed a way to pump water out of coal mines. His name was Watt. He invented the steam engine. And once they had steam engines that could burn coal, they found they had a whole bunch of coal left underground. It was just a little underwater. So, fascinating.
And also, just to let you know, history repeats itself. England tried to ban coal during the reign of Edward I, and the people that were behind the ban were the various nobles that didn't like the smoke and the smog, and they didn't much care about the fact, of course, that the country people needed it for warmth. And I think about nowadays things like the rock stars and things like that nowadays who protest nuclear and other things
that don't put much thought into how much they pay for their electric bill.
That is correct. another interesting thing that I noted while I was over in England, in London in September, doing a tour of the city, they kept pointing out the trees that were there, and I asked a fellow what type of tree one was, and he said, "I don't know that one. That's the only tree in England I don't know the name of. But why don't you ask me what the name of that tree is over there?" And I looked at it, and I thought to myself, "Well, that's a sycamore tree," and he called it the London Plane Tree. They actually imported thousands upon thousands of these sycamore trees into London maybe 150 years ago, and they've all matured now. And one of the reasons that they imported these trees into London was that the sycamore tree continuously sheds its bark, and it kind of absorbs the pollution out of the air and sheds it onto the ground, so it can be kind of a pollution control mechanism at the same time. And that was the reason that they were imported and put there.
Oh, wow, living air purifiers.
That's right.
Well, trees do a good job of that anyway, but I guess I didn't realize that they actually shed it down so you could just sweep up the pollution.
That was one of the purposes of bringing all those sycamore trees into London.
You know, if you're familiar with the work of E.F. Schumacher, he wrote a book called Small is Beautiful.
I recall him. Wasn't he one of the folks back in the 1970s, like Barry Commoner and
he was one
folks like that, about economically realigning the United States to not need nuclear or coal, or we'd be harmonically converged or something like that?
Yeah.
That sounds painful.
Well, you know, he is one of the heroes of the anti-nuclear movement. But you know what his primary job was?
No.
He was a member of Britain's National Coal Board. His job was to increase the consumption of coal. And his idea of small is beautiful was that they should bring back the individual coal-fired furnaces in people's homes. The ones that, you know...
Distributed generation.
Right, exactly. The ones that, you know, the biggest picture one can have of these is if you look, remember Mary Poppins, where they're up dancing on the roofs with the chimney sweeps. And the big haze of black coal smoke that was hanging over that and all of the little chimney pots at the top of the row houses.
I see a resurgence in coal heat coming in the United States. I've spoken to several people in the last several months that are interested in looking into putting coal heat in their houses.
Really?
And of course, I guess Rod and I's favorite physicist or non-physicist, Amory Lovins, in his original article, he talks about the advances in coal and how coal, we would use coal to replace nuclear power, and that would be better.
See, I don't actually have any heartache with coal itself. I mean, it's just a natural product. It happens to be, you know, part of the Earth's surface and does have energy content. I just think it should be burned a lot cleaner than it is today.
Certainly.
And in some way, it doesn't require the flattening of West Virginia.
It was fairly interesting talking to someone about energy and heating, going over the evolution of the heater at my grandmother's house. She bought a house that was built in around 1910, and the house, at the time it was built, had a wood-fired heater in it. It was a large centralized furnace.
Mm-hmm.
Very shortly after my grandparents moved into it, they had it converted to a coal furnace, and they would get corn delivered to their house, which they would shovel into it several times, maybe a day, a week. I wasn't there, so I wasn't privy to the amount of maintenance that a coal furnace took, but sometime in the 60s they converted it over to an oil furnace, and that's the way it stayed up until the late 80s, at which time they were strongly considering converting over to gas, as many people in the neighborhood had converted over to natural gas because that was the cheapest form of heating a house at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, natural gas has increased to the point that it's actually cheaper to heat a house by electrical baseboard heat than it is to heat a house by oil or natural gas. So it's fascinating turnaround that people are now starting to consider coal as a heating option for their houses again, after all of those iterations that it's gone through.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You can devolve all of these sources so you can compare apples to apples, and that's by converting them all to BTUs. And up until very recently, you know, one of the problems that you have, though, is all of the different fuel sources like to quote their price in different terms. Oil quotes it in dollars per barrel, and natural gas quotes it in dollars per 1,000 cubic feet, and coal quotes it in dollars per ton.
Right.
And electricity is kilowatt hours, so...
It makes it very difficult to do a straight side-by-side comparison on them. I actually got a book of conversions, some type of engineering book, back when I was building my house,
mm-hmm.
And I put in a geothermal heat pump in my house at the time. It's still operating wonderfully today and has long since paid for itself. But at the time, I was looking for a backup source of heat, and I was going to go with a cheapest source of backup heat that I could get. And I ended up putting propane as the backup source of heat. It wasn't the least expensive option, but it was among the lowest.
Mm-hmm.
And I disconnected the strip heaters as the backup source of heat for the heat pump. Today, it would be cheaper for me to disconnect the propane and put the strip heaters back on.
Well, up until last year, living in Maryland, that was true for me. And I live in an all-electric house, and it was wonderful. But then the freeze on the electric rates ended, and my cost per kilowatt hour went from 5.1 cents to 11 cents.
Yeah, that made nationwide headlines.
Yeah, well, it makes monthly headlines in my house.
Yeah.
Every time I open the bill. And actually, I hide myself from that. I let my wife pay the bill, so I
don't see how the rest of the country is not going to be affected by that in some way very soon. I was giving a presentation to the Rotary Club just earlier last week, and I was letting them know that in the last 15 years, the electric use has increased by about 8.5%, but the cost has only increased by about 1.6% for Virginia. What that translates to is it's about 25% less when you correct for the cost of inflation.
Right. Well, Virginia and Maryland also were lucky that we were able to keep the cost of electricity down, because the cost of the fuel which is the major part of the cost of electricity, was under control because we both had lots of coal and nuclear. But natural gas prices have gone up tremendously in the last 7 years. I remember back in 1999, natural gas was under $2 per million BTU, and now it's stubbornly above $8 per million BTU.
And part of that, of course, is that we built 200,000 megawatts of gas turbines and, I guess for want of a better term, burned out all the gas in Canada, and now we even have to import more LNG.
Right. Well, it's amazing. Yeah,
everybody assumes that they want low electricity prices or low energy prices. What most people don't recognize is what they really want is predictability in the bill. You know, even if the bill went up slowly over time, but you knew it was only going to go up a little bit and it wouldn't put a bite on your budget, you know, this month when I can't pay the bill, that's kind of how utilities look at it. It's not, utilities see the benefit not just of low prices for right now or whatever's cheapest, but what is the most predictable over the long term so that you can have the resources available to pay the bill when it comes in, kind of thing.
And one of the reasons utilities stayed away from nuclear is they couldn't predict what it would cost to build a plant, and they couldn't predict how long it would take. So they went to natural gas because they thought it was predictable. And the reason that they could do that, even though the fuel price, which is 90% of the cost of electricity from natural gas, they could do that even though that price is unpredictable, because most publicly regulated utilities have something called a fuel adjustment surcharge, that they can go to the Public Utility Commission and get adjusted much more quickly than they can almost anything else. And, of course, to the customer, it doesn't really matter to me whether it's the fuel adjustment charge which increases or the cost of electricity that increases. I just know my bill increases.
And, of course, also just the fact that the gas turbines were so easy to build and operate.
Right, but a utility, if they would have had to pay the fuel bill themselves without the ability to pass that on to their customers, would have been much more careful about the risk associated with the increase of fuel prices. Utility guys aren't silly. I mean, they're smart enough to understand the law of supply and demand. You know, if everybody's sucking on gas, the price of gas is bound to go up. Right?
Although I remember a lot of industry press in the 90s of, I'll simply say, overestimation of the gas reserves, and maybe underestimation of the opposition when it came time to bring in the LNG.
Yeah. Well, LNG is, if you look at what you have to do to build LNG infrastructure, it's incredibly expensive over a long period of time to do that. You have to have very long-term contracts to make the economics work for LNG. So many of the folks that have tried to bring in LNG, just they stop because of the economics. It's hard to make it work.
But yeah, most of the LNG I know in Asia is, again, because they're able to enforce long-term contracts.
Right. Yep. And they have a little bit less opposition. But, you know, many people, and you guys are probably, I don't want to cast aspersions, but many people discount the motives that economics can bring. If one is a supplier of natural gas and understands the law of supply and demand, isn't the motive to slow down competition pretty obvious?
I guess it depends on if they have other holdings. I mean, I'm sure the coal companies were not very happy in the 1990s with 200,000 megawatts of gas turbines going up, but they didn't seem to be able to stop them. But I guess if you have all your eggs in one basket, certainly you're probably going to be more interested in pursuing what's in your area.
Yeah, and if you run a railroad, you're not particularly interested in helping the natural gas industry since you can't transport gas by rail.
But you are interested in helping coal, since that's what's paying for keeping your rails in good shape.
Well, I think, Kelly, that you're a little more generous to the railroad companies than I am, since most of the rails around the country are not in good shape. It's what's paying for your large salaries if you're the owner of the railroad. I'm sorry. I'm just a cynic at heart. I just wrote.
Yes, you are, Rod.
I just took a train ride from D.C. to New York City. Suppose, you know, the Eastern Corridor, you know, the highest traveled part of the rails. What a mess.
Rod, you're not riding a commuter rail, hon.
I was riding on the Acela.
You are not listening. Passengers do not pay for the rails.
But the rails were in bad
shape. So you can say it's the highest traveled corridor, but passengers are not their bread and butter. It's transporting big stuff like coal, which runs from east to west, not north to south.
Okay. I thought coal ran from west to east, though.
Yeah, you're right. It's west to east.
Okay.
Yeah, the empty cars go east to west.
That's right. I mean, and the coal cars are so so economical that they don't even bother to cover the coal. I mean, most of those trains run on uncovered coal cars. I see the big piles of coal with the train going down the path.
Yeah, I remember as a kid I used to go out and collect those piles of coal and bring them home.
That's when you had a coal furnace, right?
Yeah.
I had a relative that lived across the street from one of those rail lines, and that was how she heated her home, was by going out and picking up the leavings on the railway.
You know, it doesn't seem to me that anybody on this call is part of the elite intelligentsia or whatever. It doesn't. I think we're all intelligent. I'm not, don't put me. But it doesn't sound like any of us are from wealth.
I'm glad you added that.
No, I'm very concerned about what is going to happen to people whose income is such that they would pick up coal, you know, and their family income is such that they're really worried about which is the better price of heat. Because those people are going to be hurt in the next few years, because the price of fuels is really, really high.
I tell you, Rod, I agree with you. It really scares me that the price of electricity is very likely going to double or triple in the next decade or two. Not only because demand is going to increase. I mean, GM is talking about launching its Bolt car in a couple of years, and people are going to be plugging into the grid and drawing a lot of electricity off of it. But also because of this move towards the carbon-free emissions, carbon capture, clean coal, renewable portfolio standards, all of that is going to come with a tremendous price, and it's going to drive the basic price of electricity very, very high. And the same thing that we've seen happen in gasoline prices in the past 10 years, I don't see how it's possible we can avoid that in electricity prices the next 10 to 15 years.
And that's really scary. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal a lot, and I see people write things and say, you know, it's no big deal that the price of gasoline is $3.10 a gallon. You know, it's on an inflation-adjusted basis, it's cheaper than it was in 1970, but or 1974, 79, or wherever they compare it to. But all I know is that I make a pretty good living. Yet when I fill up my wife's car, it cost about $60 to fill up the car. That's enough to take both of us out for a nice dinner.
Sure. And when you combine that with the increase in food prices that's happened as a result of partially as a result of all this ethanol production, you know, the food prices are increasing as a result of the increase in transportation costs associated with getting that food to the grocery stores. When you combine all those things together, the outlook for the average to lower income American is going to be looking a lot harder over the next 10 years as it was in the previous 10 years.
Okay, you're all depressing me. What's the answer?
Well, since this is a nuclear podcast, wind power. No.
Yeah, the answer is to unplug from the grid, and all that money that you save on your electric bill, you can spend on groceries.
Well, I can definitely tell you what part of the answer is, Rod. Here in Virginia, I was looking at the Dominion's project to put up, 164 megawatts of wind turbines that are supposed to come online in 2009. And one of the sales pitches in that was that it would generate enough electricity to power 41,000 homes.
And I take exception to that because, you know, somebody else pointed it out just last week that a megawatt can power somewhere between 250 and 1,000 homes, depending on where you live in the United States. But wind capacity is not going to provide that power continuously. And the other problem with Virginia is that over the past 10 to 15 years, what I've seen anyway, is that this housing market, people have been building 4,000-square-foot houses for two adults, a child, and a dog. And they have to keep those houses. It seems like to me one of the best ways we can reduce our demand for power is to start building smaller homes that are a little bit more reasonable in amount of size and the amount of power that they require for heating.
Oh, we will build smaller homes if people keep having to spend as much money as they are for fuels. Even people making good salaries are going to recognize that the big houses are an albatross. I remember there was a time when people who had the big houses in Newport, which were certainly not poor people, decided it was just too darn expensive to heat them, and they started giving them away to historical societies and stuff. That was back when I was in college in the late 1970s, after the Iranian hostage crisis bumped the price of oil up by a factor of four. So, hey, guys, I think it's been great fun, and I'd like to see if we can get together again at a reasonably similar time and place next week. And hopefully there's going to be some more good news to talk about in the nuclear industry. I think that I'm excited. How many of you think that this is a good time to be a nuke?
Oh, pick me. I know.
I think it's a good time to be anywhere in the industry, in the energy sector of the industry, but for nuclear power especially.
This has been better than it. I've been doing this now, like Kelly, about 21 years, and this has probably been the best it's been since I've been in the business.
Any big pay raises coming up these days?
What was the question?
I said any big pay raises coming as the market demand increases and the supply of nukes, of course, is going to lag behind the demand.
Well, now, it's funny that you should mention that. If they're going to start building, probably breaking ground by 2009, the big pay increases will come initially with the construction sector, and that'll be construction of all power stations and probably construction of all industry.
I'm
because there'll be a shortage of labor in order to be able to build the nukes that'll be going in.
I'm thinking it'll be a good time to be a welder.
Yeah.
Or
welder.
Or an SRO.
Or building scaffolding. All of that is,
oh, yeah.
You know, some really interesting numbers will be coming out of that.
Maybe
I understand licensed operators already, the salaries are going up on the licensed operators.
Yeah, because the industry that's already in place wants to keep what they got.
And you can't, and it takes more than 2 weeks to get someone a license.
Really? I'm sorry.
Yeah, really.
No,
they're talking 18 to 24 months, so that's before the unit goes online, plus you have to go through the training program and everything else. You're talking about a three-year commitment for your first shift of operators to bring your reactor critical.
And even if you hire someone who has a license from a plant that's very similar, it's still a minimum 6 months in class to train on certain specifics of the site before you can let them at the boards.
Right. And since all of the reactors are going to be built in the next generation probably don't qualify as being similar, it's going to take a good, serious training program to get those people ready to go by the time the plan is ready to go online. But that is going to be a while.
There might even be jobs for all of us at the end of this.
I don't know about you, but I've got a job.
I do too. I'll just be able to keep it. That'll be the.
We're trying to phase out fossil.
All right. You guys take care.
Okay.
This is fun.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Ooh, there's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.